Hi, and welcome to another episode of Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz in the beautiful Portland, Oregon.
This is Will Clayton.
Is it raining today, Ben? That's what I want to know.
No, we had blue skies and 60 degrees, and I mowed my lawn with a real mower, if anyone's familiar with that. Super hippie.
Okay.
Welcome, Will.
Only in Portland, Ben. Yeah, welcome. Let's welcome Will. Will Clayton.
Thanks for having me.
Is back with us from Birmingham, Alabama. Thomas is working again, so he couldn't be with us. And then Hunter's off doing something of some kind.
We love Hunter.
To quote the jerk, you know, Lord loves a working man, never trust Whitey. So he can't hurt. I hate Thomas too much for wanting to work.
Well played.
Okay, so, yeah, so Ben, what have you been watching?
Well, I watched Sicario over the weekend. Very late to the game on that. I accept that all the comments related to that. But, I really wish I'd seen it in theater.
Yeah.
I don't say that often, but Deakins cinematography is
phenomenal.
Mind-boggling.
Phenomenal.
And I could not get the picture settings right on my TV to really appreciate a lot of the tunnel sequences and the early morning, late night.
Oh, yeah.
They shot a lot of it really dark. And I couldn't really enjoy it, honestly, as much as I wanted to, but it was fantastic. Brandon.
Yeah.
What have you been watching?
You skip Will? Okay.
No, I mean, we'll come back around. Will, what have you been watching?
As a matter of fact, last night I finally rewatched Sin City in its entirety in one sitting.
Oh, wow.
Not something one normally does. I guess it's been out for a few years. But I guess after our conversations the last week at comic books, I was going through other comic book R-rated films, and that one popped up. Other than that, just some more Better Call Saul. Yeah. But that's what I've been watching. What have you been watching recently, Brandon?
We're all just waiting for me. This is not the topic we're going to be discussing, but first off, I just recently watched The Ice Storm. It was a movie directed by Ang Lee, one of his first American films. We watched it in a class at USC, Thomas and I did. Never seen it, loved it. Kevin Kline's in it, Joan Allen, Sigourney Weaver, young Tobey Maguire, Christina Ricci. It's like an intimate type drama. Ben, I think you might like it. I don't know.
No, this looks great, and it's looks like it's Criterion. It's,
yeah, I like Thomas and I talked about afterwards. Like, we just really want more Kevin Kline in movies. Like, '90s Kevin Kline, '80s and '90s Kevin Kline is great. And
don't call him stupid though.
I mean, I think you're gonna have a hard time getting that particular decade of him to.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I know that. But I agree with you.
We
need more Kevin Kline, and he hasn't. The last thing he probably did was Last Vegas. Oh no, he did Ricky and the Flash. I forgot about that. I did see him do that, and he's in Beauty and the Beast coming out next year. But yeah, so that's what I've been watching. I've been watching more films, but that's kind of one of the ones I watched recently. I've been watching a little bit more TV, and a recent show that I've been watching is because one of my professors talked about it before it came out, and after also living in LA, it's become kind of a big thing. Is I've been watching American Crime Story, People versus O.J. Simpson. What happened with O.J. Simpson show? We're on episode 3, and the show's on FX. And this kind of leads to our topic tonight. Was that they started dropping some language that people didn't expect. And at the very end of episode 3, I'll just go ahead and say it. Sarah Paulson as Marcia Clark, when Johnny Cochran is announced as one of the members of the Dream Team for Simpsons lawyers, she goes, motherfucker.
Wow.
Is what she says.
Which is considered profanity by most
people.
Yeah,
it is considered profanity. And I don't usually say it on the podcast, but I'll say it because it's part of a show.
Yeah, but we've marked this episode as explicit in our podcast feed.
Yeah, and so, and they said it at the end of episode 3, and then in episode 4, Travolta says something along the same lines, and it's more of a throwaway scene, but they're starting to, there's like people, it made us, made me and a number of other people research like how they could say it, like why, like it's on FX, how they get that by the censors or whatever. And what I came to find out was that the FCC does not actually have any authority over any cable networks.
Right.
They only have authority over the big networks like ABC, CBS, Fox, NBC, and CW. Every other network or every other cable network after that is mainly just going by pleasing advertisers and audience and the audience. And people really didn't know that. And I didn't know that basically they could do whatever they want to. They could FX, even the Discovery Channel or anything. If the Discovery Channel could want to put Game of Thrones sex and violence on there, they could. And that was something I did not know going into this.
I've watched Discovery Channel at that point, being perfectly honest.
It's like, that's what's, it's like people didn't know that you had the ability to do that on a consistent basis, not just like a one-off thing. It's like it can do that whenever you want to.
Well, and so I, you know, when we started talking about this through chat before the show, I started looking into it. And it's similar to the MPAA, which is that it's an industry body that self-assigns these ratings. And so it's kind of a self-censorship. It's a self-policing of the, you know, by the networks and the producers to all kind of say, hey, you know, these are the, you know, basically social norms is what it really comes down to. Because, you know, there's the documentary about the MPAA where they had to create this whole illusion, or, you know, illusion is my choice of words, but institution of the rating system to kind of like stave off the efforts of political interest in regulating the industry. Basically, it was, you know, the message of it was either you guys clean up your own act or we're going to step in and start regulating what you can make and produce through our own censorship or ratings. And so, you know, that's how these bodies, industry bodies, came about, is to basically say, hey, look, let's try not to, and this is my own poor, you know, reconstruction of history, but, you know, let's limit controversy as much as possible so as not to arouse, oh, you like that? so as not to raise concern from, you know, from angry parents, angry people, you know, because of the content of these shows.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this, man. Is this your first show you've watched that's on FX while it's been broadcast?
While it's been broadcast,
so did you? So you missed out on Sons of Anarchy, and you missed out on
Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad.
Well, that was AMC.
Oh, sorry, AMC. But see, also going on off of that is that Breaking Bad, I know they would, at least when the seasons I've watched since then, they would also throw in cuss words like
yes.
And I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know I could do that. I guess it's just for the DVD release. I didn't realize that they could do that on the network. And no, so this is like Nip Tuck I had never seen before. And I know Thomas told me that Nip Tuck had like a good bit of nudity.
Yes, very graphic.
Yeah, involved in it. And, you know, I never watched anything on FX before watching OJ in its like run while on television.
Yeah, I mean, so to kind of go a little bit on that further. I mean, FX, I guess they still have movies, but with their original programming, they've been really pushing the boundary for a good while. I mean, they've had some great success with programs, too. I mean, the first couple years of Nip Tuck were solid. I can't speak for the latter half of that show. And, of course, I'm pretty sure everyone likes The Americans as well. If you don't watch that show, you're missing out some excellent television. But they've been doing this for a while. So I guess what I find interesting is that someone would be surprised that cable television is able to do more things than network is. You know, that was kind of the reason people pushed for cable in the first place, was that they were allowed to push the envelope further. They were allowed to show more, allowed to do more. What was the thing that Julie Louis-Dreyfus said about her favorite thing about doing Veep was that on HBO, you know, you can say the seven dirty words you're not supposed to say and do it repeatedly. And if you don't watch Veep, it's one of my favorite comedies on television the last few years. They turn swearing into Shakespeare. It's an art form. I mean, they take it to levels you would have never imagined. I mean, it's almost beautiful how they use foul language. That really, it's It is a bigger playground with Cable, and that's one of the things I think is makes it a little more interesting as well.
Well, so like, I knew they could do more on Cable. I didn't know they could do that much. Like, because growing up, like, I remember on Comedy Central, like, after a certain time of night, they could show Friday, and it'd be, like, uncensored. And so, like, once it hits, like, midnight or one, you could show that. See, I didn't know you could do that whenever you wanted to. I thought, like, because I know the first thing I think Ben or Hunter, one of them asked in the text was like, oh, well, what time did it show? Was it like later on at night? And the thing is about OJ was it was the first primetime show. Well, no, reportedly the first primetime show to use that particular phrase on its show. To my knowledge and to like the articles I read.
Well, you know, because when you say that phrase, I mean, like, when you watch some of the documentary, what's the name of that documentary about the MPAA?
The film is not yet rated.
Yeah, the film is not yet rated. I mean, they talk about how, in particular, you know, fuck and motherfucker, if it's used, they parse it differently based on if it applies to sexual or non-sexual, which is, you know, I don't know. It's like lawyers trying to decide, you know, what is, you know, apropos. Mm-hmm.
And even then, I mean, that's that becomes even more hilarious with the MPAA. I mean, their standards can be lobbied, obviously.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if you're familiar with the South Park film that they did back in the 90s, but they went through negotiation with the MPAA back and forth on the cut of the film, how many times they had to take certain words or certain phrases. And quite frankly, South Park got the better half of the deal when they changed the title of the film to be basically a dick joke, which is the title of the film is South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. And they basically made a very, very subtle jab at the MPAA there, saying that, look, you guys, we don't really care. I mean, it's to us it's humor, to us it's funny. And I mean, if you want to give us an NC-17 rating, which they originally wanted to, of course, it would have killed the film in terms of probably overall viewership. At that point, South Park wasn't nearly as big of a deal. It still took another few years for that to really sort of take off. But I think you see that a lot. I mean, you've seen even within Comedy Central, which is technically cable, they censor South Park quite frequently. I mean, you can get the uncensored versions online, and there was a point where I thought that early on in that show's history, where the jokes were made with the intention of it being censored because it sounded funnier through the censor, and so you can do different things with it and play with it. That I'm not sure. I'm a little bit at a disadvantage because I haven't watched any of the O.J. Simpson show yet. I've heard it's phenomenal. It's just not up on my list right now.
I can tell you, just going off that, I know Thomas does not actually like it that much. I'll give him No, he doesn't really like it that much. I enjoy it. This goes into a different topic of performances and stuff like that. I do enjoy it. I think sometimes there are some flaws to it to me, and particularly in the way it's shot, like the way certain things are handled, especially in the first episode with these huge sweeping shots, and it feels like there's no real reason for it. And David Schwimmer constantly says juice over and over again, like, because like he doesn't call OJ, he calls him juice. Or the juice.
Right.
And so it's like, they did a supercut recently. It's like a 3-minute version of just David Schwimmer in the first 3 episodes saying juice.
That bothers you?
No, it doesn't bother me. I'm just thinking, well, no, it bothers me because it's like, it's in dialogue. It sounds terrible when David Schwimmer will say juice 5 times in one scene.
His nickname, though. I mean, that's what everyone called him.
Yeah, but here's the thing. This is a whole different conversation what we're talking about. But
Is it the way that David Schwimmer says it? I mean, is that what the issue is?
No. I'm saying when you're talking to someone in real life, how many times do you say their name?
Depends on the person.
Brandon, I pretty frequently say your name.
Yeah, but you're usually trying to make a point, right?
Brandon, I'm not always making a point when I say your name.
Okay.
I see what you did there.
When it comes to film. When I hear someone being called their name like 5 different times in one scene, sometimes he says it 3 times in a sentence. Like, it's not like it feels awkward. And
can you use that in an example sentence?
I will post it in the show notes, the video of David Schwimmer saying juice over and over again.
Well, have you considered, is it, who's his character? Who's he playing? Is he playing Kardashian? Is he playing?
He's playing Kardashian.
Is it possible that's just part of his character? Because he's sort of, kind of sleazy, a little bit grimy, as I remember from the footage and the research.
They don't put him as sleazy and grimy, really. That's the thing.
Really?
Is that he's this loyal friend of OJ's.
Well, but maybe just, he's subtly slimy, because anyone who says your name over and over is not trustworthy.
From a story perspective, it's that when you're writing a script, you should not be putting, like, you don't say the character's name, like, you don't say their name over and over again. I'm sorry, it doesn't happen. When you're in real life, you don't say, like, if you're in a conversation, except Ben, apparently, you do not, like, say a person's name. You might say it one time. I have spoken to people who have probably not said my name since I first met them. Like, that's just like...
That's because they forgot really... it, Brandon.
Thank you, Ben. It's like they'll say, hey, Brandon, at the very beginning of the conversation, and they never say it again.
Okay. So, as a screenwriter, it bothered you because you wouldn't use the name
that much. It
bothers
me, yes. Okay. And everyone's noticing that, too. Or certain people
are noticing
that.
Now, again, I haven't seen the show, but just based off of what you're saying, I'm going to try and read into this a little bit. And have they built up OJ's narcissism at all?
They've done it in a few scenes, but not much. The one they really did it, which I think was said, was when they're talking about OJ and how he's talking about how he's a black man, or no, he like the whites don't like because he's a black man. He goes, I'm not black. I'm OJ. Is like what he says. They don't build up his narcissism as much as they should, as they could, because. And honestly, I mean, end of episode two, I think he's been in jail the entire time. So like they'll cut to him and he'll be in a cell, or he might talk to a lawyer. But no, not really as much as they could. They'll probably do more a little bit when it gets into the trial stuff. But no, I'm just saying it gets annoying when you hear David Schwimmer keep saying juice over and over again. And I'm just saying I wouldn't write that. And I think some of the dialogue has problems. But I'm not saying it's a bad show. I like the show more than Thomas does, I'll say that. Go ahead, Ben.
So other than this thrilling critique of the use of his name in the show.
Juice, yeah. Oh my god, this is completely like gone down the rabbit hole.
I'd love to have Thomas on and have a 45-minute debate over the use or non-use of the name, but to bring it back around a little bit about this basic idea of, the thing that you started with that cued something in my mind is you were saying, what time did the show play?
Yeah.
Right, as far as the show came on at 9, and it's one of the first to use this phrase in an earlier time. And, it gets back to that time is a, what time the show played is an arbitrary thing that's not enforced by the government or anybody. It's purely just what do the networks think they can do without losing advertisers? Because remember, I grew up in a pretty conservative religious house, right? And I remember different boycotts of television shows or Disney or whatever because of controversial things that they were doing. I remember hearing about this stuff, right? So you have like the... What is it? There's like a moms group, like 10,000 moms or concerned moms of America. I don't know what it is, and I'm not being completely dismissive.
Isn't it 1 million moms?
Yeah, maybe? There it is. They concern, or they raised enough concern for some of these networks to limit the sorts of things that they did because they didn't want to get put on that list. Because if you get put on the list, then you can't advertise detergent and Cadillacs and products that appeal to people who care about such boycotts. You know what I mean? That's the circular thinking of all that. But, here's where I want to expand the topic a little bit, is that a lot of that thinking is fueled by advertisers. I mean, it's fueled by money, right? It's fueled by advertisers who pay for these shows. Even though people are paying for cable, a lot of the money still comes in through advertising. And nowadays, I mean, here's the thing, is like, you almost have to push the envelope if you're FX. If you're really trying to get notoriety and attention, it would be great for them to probably be boycotted at this phase.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they're competing against channels and, honestly, just websites that don't mm-hmm. don't give a fuck, since we're using the, you know, the phrases liberally in this episode. You know, Will, you had a rant about HBO. I'd like to go ahead and play that whenever you're ready. But, I mean, that's who they're competing with, right? Is the Netflix and the HBOs of the world, or just internet videos in general, who are not playing by these rules. And some of them are not relying on advertisers, is the main reason why they're not playing by those rules. HBO, you know, doesn't care what, you know, your mom thinks about laundry detergent, or the maker of a laundry detergent cares about Game of Thrones. They're going to show whatever they want to show.
As I recall, in the same similar groups of folks back during the 80s and 90s of HBO's early days, I believe the actual nickname for HBO back then by certain of those groups was Hell's Box Office. You know, because they would show nudity and language and things, and I'm pretty sure most of the, you know, the, I'm sure they've got their adult entertainment side of HBO around there somewhere in their programming, but I'm pretty sure most of that's gone over to Skinemax at this point. But we're really, to talk about HBO a little bit, let's just take the biggest one that's on people's minds these days, Game of Thrones. As some of us who like the show and enjoy the show, we jokingly and lovingly call it Game of Tits, because there is a great deal of female nudity in the show, and... the whole joke was during the first few seasons that it looked like the show was written by 17-year-old boys because all the women were beautiful and naked half the time, and there was plenty of violence and beheading. Who doesn't enjoy that stuff, right? I mean, clearly, it's a massive pull. It's this massive event show. But that is what FX is especially competing with. You're talking about a program, HBO, who's... Their production budget on that is, I don't remember the number exactly, but it's one of the most expensive shows ever made. And the fact that they're still throwing money at it, and they're getting the viewers, and HBO doesn't care if you give away your HBO Go password or not. They don't really care if the episodes get downloaded illegally or the internet or not. They just want eyeballs on the show, because it increases their branding, etc. But they have that, they have the, I don't want to say luxury of that, but because they've basically built themselves into a brand of saying, we make really good drama. That's what they are known for now. And it all goes back to The Sopranos. If we didn't have The Sopranos, none of this would be a thing, really. Because after The Sopranos, you get it's basically the same. Their big show at the time would have been Sex and the City. Without Sex and the City, you wouldn't get Girls and half the shows that we get on comedy these days, and especially that deal with... issues of young women and young adulthood, especially in general, or being an adult overall. And then, of course, you get The Wire, which I still argue is one of the greatest television dramas of all time. If you've not seen The Wire, you're doing yourself a disservice if you're a fan of television. You need to go back immediately, as soon as you have the opportunity, and get an HBO Go account, get a password, watch The Wire. And then, of course, you've got their whole Band of Brothers. They make these shows that... aren't necessarily specifically designed for adult audiences, but adults are specifically enjoy them. That and you get all sorts of types that will watch HBO. Of course, you've got your sort of fantasy genre fans like myself who enjoy Game of Thrones, but I'm also a big fan of The Leftovers, or at least I liked parts of The Leftovers from season one. I still haven't finished season two, so I can't tell if I still like that show or not. But you've also got, you think about it even further, I mean, your fathers and grandfathers that might not necessarily be into the gore and the nudity that you might get on some of their other programs, but really enjoy Band of Brothers and The Pacific. You know, it's that there's a certain nostalgia, the taking war seriously, showing these real graphic war stories that you're not going to movies to watch. You're not watching Saving Private Ryan. You're watching 45 minutes to 60 minutes a week for 11 weeks maybe. And then, or a show like my mother, who she loves, John Adams, the miniseries I did several years ago, Paul Giamatti, great show.
Great show. Yeah,
I mean that was great. Tom Hooper, wasn't it? Did all that? I mean, you're talking about
it was.
This is a place now where I've read some great TV reporters like Andy Greenwald talk about this before, where you're seeing a lot of the movie guys coming to cable. Because there's more freedom there, and it's allowing you to do more.
Yeah.
And so in comparison with, to go back to our topic in general of what are we doing when it comes to censorship necessarily, or the what can and can't you show, I'll transition to Showtime a little bit. Do any of you watch Showtime at all, any of their programs?
Not in a
First one that comes to mind for me is The Tudors. Did you watch The Tudors? Also known as the sexiest show on television, because it's nothing but nudity and playing fast.
I watched a couple of the seasons of it.
Yeah, so bothered me for a little while. As a history major, it bothered me to a little bit of a degree. But that had, you're basically talking about if Henry VIII was not sleeping with at least two beautiful women completely nude per episode, they were not hitting their quota. To go similarly, Penny Dreadful. First season of Penny Dreadful. You have a full sequence where it is Ava Green nude, writhing on a bed where she's supposed to be having intercourse with a demon of some type. Like, total nudity right there. Mm-hmm. And even though it's Showtime, I was actually surprised that they went there. I was just sort of, wow, this is apparently happening now. And but they do that, especially on some of these cable shows, because I do think that the idea still exists that sex sells. That by going the nudity route, by going with more open and very graphic sexual depictions in cable, that it will generate eyeballs, if just for the controversy as well. People go, oh my God, did you see what they did this week? I mean,
a lot of the data, I think, backs that up. You know what I mean? We don't have access to all of it, but sex does sell. That's not really in question anymore. And for a lot of these cable shows, not necessarily broadcast, but for cable, if you're just a self-regulating group, you know, if you're just self-censoring to be, appropriate, but, you know, it's clearly shifted over time that you want to be near the front of that pack, pushing what is deemed appropriate or not appropriate, because you're going to get some headlines, you know, like we have in the show notes about the People versus OJ, or so, like you said, with some of these Showtime shows. You know, I've watched quite a few of the pilots on HBO. When I had an HBO account, I watched, you know, Boardwalk Empire, the first episode of Sopranos. Almost as kind of a writing exercise, and there's a very specific HBO pilot. You know, as silly as it is, almost all of their shows, when you watch the pilot episode, they're going to have some sort of sexual encounter, you know, and it's probably going to involve substantial female nudity and not necessarily male nudity, which is another interesting aspect of all this. You know what I mean? They know what they want to do, and they repeatedly do it over and over. And so the real question, I think, with some of this is, like, move the ball forward a little bit is, you know, is there any, if you were one of these networks or if you were making one of these shows, is there any reason not to, as simple as that question is, but beyond that, like, is there really anything to be done about any of this? If you were opposed to some of these things being out there in the world, I guess, which is a kind of old school way of thinking about this, like 20 years ago, people boycotting these shows, you don't really see a lot of those boycotts anymore because, you know, number one, the internet, but number two, what really is the proposal to change some of this?
There's another question that's not being proffered, which is there something wrong inherently with doing more quote unquote adult themes or adult content? And depending on how one answers that question, will then guide your conversation and your conclusions a little bit further. Personally, when it comes to cable television, at least, I believe that you have the freedom and should explore those areas without going necessarily gratuitously, you know, in terms of taste. So, for example, one of my favorite shows that's on HBO, it's no longer on the air, but Rome, if you go back and watch that, it's a very well-done historical drama. However, their sexual elements in the show are kind of hilariously bad, at least in the first few episodes. They get it right with Mark Antony and they get it right with Cleopatra, but sometimes it just feels forced. And I think that's the biggest issue that people have, is when something doesn't feel natural to the show. If it works for the show, if it makes sense for the character, if it makes sense for the story, I'm all for it. Just for another example, Ava Green again. Did you guys watch, since I watched Sin City the other day, the second Sin City, A Dame to Kill For, did you see that at all? Possibly?
I've not watched that, but I do know the whole controversy about the poster that came out with her.
Yes, that's what I was going to mention.
That was Yeah, that was the big thing.
If you didn't know this, Ben, in the original poster art for A Dame to Kill, or Dame to Kill 4, Ava Green is she's clothed, but you can clearly see nipple in her through her dress. So the international posters, it's there. The U.S. posters, it's not there. The U.S. marketing did not allow it in their posters. And she actually, I believe, is either with some talk show. I want to say it was possibly Craig Ferguson back when he was still around. But they're asking about, you know, what's the deal with Americans not being fond of nudity? And of course, people say, you know, France is much more sexually liberated, or at least that's the idea. But there is something to be said that she said that she was comfortable with it because it made sense for the character. It made sense for the story. And so I kind of, I will say I will agree with Ava Green on that part there, that if it makes sense for your story and for your characters, let your writers and let your directors and let your actors go there. Now, don't do the Game of Thrones thing where you necessarily shove in a naked woman every 20 minutes an episode just because you have to have one. There's been several moments in that show where I'm like, really, guys? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of wonder if the thing that brings some of this back a little bit, just because I completely agree with you that I think that when it's when any sort of violence or language or nudity or sexuality is inherent to a story, it feels authentic and it gives it some sort of justification for existing. And I wonder if some of the pushback against some of this stuff won't just come from people saying that it's just outright kind of sexist and just weird to just randomly have, you know, because you see this sometimes on Twitter and some of the pushback against, you know, the Game of Thrones scenes where there's just no reason for, you know, there's just no reason for some of it other than we can do it. We know people like it. Enough people like it that we do it, and I, you know, I wonder as more people kind of speak out about it, if it's more constrained to be, I you know, constrained seems weird to say, but if it's more limited to stories that inherently, you know, require it, or in a way it makes sense, you know, because some of the HBO stuff is just, it doesn't bother me in the sense that I'm a prude.
It's unnecessary.
It bothers me in the sense that I just think it's dumb, and I just turn it off. Honestly, I just turn it off because it's not like, you know, it's not interesting. Basically, it's dumb, you know?
One thing, too, because I've actually seen a lot of recent student films that are actually doing that more.
More nudity in student film?
Yeah. Like, out here in California,
Well.
Like, nudity and sex. I'm not going to say the ones I've seen, but there's been some I've seen, and I'm just like, what's the purpose of that? I'm like, is it just this show that you can, like, that you shot a really, like, hard? Because it was, like, some of the stuff I've seen is, it's like softcore porn, and it's like on a student
film.
Well,
let me ask you this, Brandon. Have you I'm sure you've heard this, you might have heard this joke before, at least you should in LA. What's the difference between prostitution and pornography?
What is it?
There's a camera involved.
All right.
I mean, because what I think where you're going with that in general, though, is fascinating that you're saying that you are seeing people just for the sake of, hey, we can do it. Let's throw in a topless scene. Why not?
Yeah,
what I mean,
because I remember it's because I can say I dealt with this to this extent. But when we did the recent film that we did, we had a sex scene in it, and the big thing was like, what's right for the story. And what's right for this character, and like what's too far, and that's a conversation we had. But sometimes I feel like seeing wide shots of just like a full on sex scene, and also too, where it's usually the female who's the one who's the most, like who's the one you're seeing the most of. I don't see the purpose for that story. And I remember a while back, and this is like a going off of this example of like, is it right for the story? There was a scene, this is a terrible example, a scene from Terminator Salvation it didn't end up in the final cut, but there was a scene of like one of the main characters like topless. And the conversation they had was like, does this really enhance the story? Just looks like a woman, huh? Right. What?
They had actually had a topless scene in Terminator Salvation?
It ended up being cut. It was with like, the actress name was Moon Bloodgood. That was
but the fact that they even had it in the script, for a post-apocalyptic,
exactly, and they said that
and quite frankly, stupid story.
Yeah,
they had room for a room for a nudity scene, really.
Yeah, and basically what it was one of the characters had their like it was Moon Bloodgood, I think, that was like, it was like, was topless, and like it was supposed to be Sam Worthington looking at her. I think this is correct. God. because they said like it was supposed to be a very like a nice moment between the two, and then when you go back and watch Dailies, it just looks like a woman like with her top off, and that's it. And they cut it because it didn't work for the story. And I'm saying is that sometimes and I don't watch Game of Thrones that much, so I can't comment on how much they use. But from what I hear from people is that it's a lot of pushing the boundaries is fine, but you have to know why you're doing it, and you need to have a good reason, my opinion.
There are, to speak on Game of Thrones a little bit more, and I don't want to make this all a Game of Thrones conversation either, but
yeah, that's fine.
They do have some memorable moments in the show designed around the sexual content, but the memorable moments you have are the ones that are story-related. The ones that people laugh about and that we joke about are the ones where it just seems silly, like, okay, here's HBO checking off the box this week. So I'll give you an example of the two I'm talking about. So, memorable moment. I want to say it's season 3 of the show when Jon Snow and Ygritte are off together with the wildlings, and Ygritte has been sort of flirting with and being overtly sexual with Jon. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's, as a brother of the Night's Watch, he's supposed to be celibate, etc., etc., and this wildling, she doesn't care. So they end up in a cave together where Rose Leslie, the actress, I mean, it happens in the books too, just fully disrobes right there in front of the camera, full straight nudity and from behind, and commences. It's a memorable moment in the show, but first they built it up. They actually brought you to that moment, and so it actually works. And a lot of people actually said I've talked to that don't really care for the nudity on HBO actually said that was an erotic moment. That was pretty scintillating, I guess would be the word, or titillating, depending on how you want to go with that. But to give you an example of where it doesn't really make sense, where it just sort of feels like it's thrown in, there are several scenes, and I can think of the first one being in the first season between Littlefinger and his prostitutes in his brothel, where there's a scene, I don't remember the episode, where he basically, through conversation and also talking about himself, directs the two prostitutes in how to pleasure one another. And they're both topless, and I'm pretty sure they're completely naked in the scene. And he's just sort of there, guiding them through it. It really doesn't... I know they try to do it so we're building up his character sort of being this seedy guy, but we already had that in the story, so that was a moment where I was just sort of rolling my eyes a little bit. It's like, okay, this is a little much. But yeah, I think the general point is that we've made, though, is we like it when it works for story and it works for characters.
Yeah.
I guess to...
Sorry for interrupting. It was that you can be sexual without having nudity. Like some of the most sexual, like most erotic type scenes in films don't ever like have to show a lot of nudity. And I'm not saying like I don't like nudity in it. I'm just saying that sometimes it's the cheap way out of it. And there's not enough thought put into it.
Sex, Lies, and Videotape. Not a lot of nudity in that.
Yeah, exactly. Not a lot of nudity.
But incredibly erotic film. I mean, it's... Yeah. But I think that's probably... I didn't even just thought of it now. It's probably a great example of talking about you don't actually have to show it to pull off the same effect.
Exactly.
Anyway, back to...
Yeah. Ben, do you have a thought? Because you're just, like, sitting there, like, it's like your screen is frozen.
No, I'm honestly just trying to figure out how to best contribute to the conversation. Because I agree with this. And you know the basic premise that we're agreeing on, that it needs to be relevant to the story. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I do kind of want to bring it back around to, I guess, maybe the intent of the ratings, and that they're designed for parents to protect their children.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, maybe I'll just ask you guys a somewhat unfair question, but you know. If you had children, and maybe Will, I don't know.
Nope, do not have children. Okay.
Brandon, do you have any children?
Baby mama, do have nothing.
Not that I know of, Ben.
I'm just triple checking before I make this, you know. But if you did, you know, we'll move this into a hypothetical realm then. But, you know, would you, adhere to the ratings as given? you know, would you have no limits at all for your children? Like, how, you know, basically moving forward in 2020, yeah. 2025, whatever, your kid's 5, 10 years old, you know, does this matter in the way that it did when we were growing up? Just to make it as basic as, you know, simple as possible.
Let's take a look at that rating again. You say it's made for parents. I actually argue that it's made for parents that are unaware.
Yeah.
Because I think this comes back down to, like we mentioned in the previous podcast, it's about people not knowing that Deadpool is not meant for children.
Yeah.
It comes back to, if you're going to watch something with your kids, if you're going to watch a rated R film, if you're going to watch something that's TV-MA, TV-14, whatever your FCC regs might be and your ratings might be, I would make it. I would have the motivation then to actually understand what is the content in this show that they're referencing. What is the content? What's happening? I wouldn't want to just let's just pick up a random example. Okay, like Gremlins. I wouldn't want to turn Gremlins on and have to explain to my children at like the ages of 6 or 7 that Santa Claus isn't real because they said it in the movie and these monsters are going to, you know, like all of a sudden break out in during the middle of Christmas time and ruin Christmas for them, you know? I could see that as being kind of traumatic for children. Sexual adult violent content. First rated R film I saw in theaters was with my father. We went to watch Open Range with Kevin Costner when that first came out. One of my favorite traditional westerns and sort of the new school of western. But that was the first rated R film I saw in theaters. And I was probably...
I was probably
about 11 or 12 at the time.
Yeah.
But my dad, before we went, he knew the Western and knew that the reason it was rated R was for the violence and for the last 30 minutes, which is one of the best action sequences and shootouts I've seen in a long time. But that was the reason. I mean, I didn't watch Gladiator until I was probably about 14 or 15, even though that was a Best Picture winner, because of the decapitation and the nudity a little bit that's in the film as well. My dad was like, it's probably not too suitable for you just yet. So again, it just comes down to what do you want your kids to expose to? I mean, I'm not saying don't expose your kids to anything. I'm not going that route, but I'm saying I think parents understand their children pretty well and understand and should or hopefully understand their children well and what may or may not be suitable for their children.
Yeah, that's the big thing going off that is that I watched a lot of movies looking back on it. I'm surprised my parents let me watch. Like, just plain and simple. And it's like, and it's not like I wasn't like watching Friday the 13th or like Nightmare on Elm Street. I was watching comedies that as a young kid, I didn't get the jokes. I didn't know some of the jokes they were making. When I get older, I'm like, oh, that's a really fairly sexual joke that I didn't get when I was 4 years old. And it's
4 years old, okay. I thought we were talking about little Brandon at like 12, but
no. Like when I watched Blank Man and a lot of Damon Wayans stuff, Blank Man, Major Payne. And I'm trying to think of other stuff. I mean, I remember watching Men in Black when it came out.
See, but and this to me, like, what you're saying is, like, you didn't get a joke, right? I mean, humor is definitely, like, kind of age-dependent. But I don't think there's anything really all that bad from a joke that you don't get versus violence is something you get very early.
Yeah. I grew up, again, like, watching Batman movies at a young age. Granted, they're not as violent as, say, Nolan's Batman, or what this next Batman with Snyder might be, because it's supposed to be rated R for the home video release.
Which is hilarious, by the way.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. I wanted to drop
like
that.
Deadpool ripoff? Well, like, why is it... Why?
Basically,
I would love to save that for a future podcast. I would love to rant a little bit about Zack Snyder and Man of Steel, but...
What happened with me, because the first rated R movie I ever saw was actually Terminator 3. That was the first movie I saw that was rated R in theaters.
The Claire Danes one?
Yes, that one. And so that was more for violence than anything, and violence and language. Now, it's... To me, and I'm not every other person out there, is that I knew what was fiction and what wasn't, and what was real. And it was because I grew up watching movies. And also, too, is that I had parents that would talk about that with me, or that they could tell, like, if it wasn't right for, like, me to watch. Like, I wasn't watching Pulp Fiction in the mid-90s or whatever. Like, I was watching Forrest Gump. Like, that's how it went. And I can tell you, for example, this is a story I like telling for some reason, is that in 2006, so I was probably 15, Borat came out, Sacha Baron Cohen came out, that movie came out. I really wanted to see it. And my dad's like, I'll go see it first.
Right.
And then I'll tell you if it's like okay for you to see. He went to see it, said, okay, let's go see it. And so my dad saw Borat, then took me to go see it again. And this is like fairly like sexual, a lot of language. Like, I mean, there's Bear Cohen and a old fat guy running around naked, like 69ing one another in front of people. Like, it's a fairly like, I'm like, wow, Daddy, let me go see this movie.
Very nice. How much?
Well, I think that that's a launching off point just a little bit back into this. I keep coming back around to it, but like the first R movie I saw in theater was with my dad. We went to go see The Patriot. And, you know, even now thinking back on it, there's some really graphic sequences in that film.
Yes.
You know, something like 15 or something, right? Yeah. But I mean, he machetes or hatchets people to death and has blood dripping off his face. You know, and
guy gets his head taken off with a cannonball.
Yeah, I mean, there's some strange things that go on, and I think it's interesting. Like you're saying, you know, Borat is controversial because of its nudity, but I think this
male nudity, by the way.
Yeah, male nudity, female nudity, right? Male and nudity, that's the thing is, like, I think it's a very American thing to be so fixated on nudity above, in classifying it above violence as this thing to be protecting children from. Because in a lot of other countries, a lot of other places in the world, that's not necessarily the case. There's a lot more concern over violence. And, you know, I honestly kind of tend to go that way. I mean, there was a sequence in Sense8 that I watched towards the finale where one of the key characters goes on the shooting spree and is just violently murdering people, you know, with it's just a shooting spree, just murdering people. And, you know, it's unrated, it's Netflix, we can watch whatever we want to watch. But I find that so much more disturbing, even as an adult, than, you know, just people randomly naked. That's not, you know what I mean? That's not necessarily offensive. And I think that speaks to, like, the broader culture.
Right.
We don't have time to get into that. But I think that's interesting, you know, as part of this.
Now, I have a question for you, Ben. Now, with Sense8, was that scene, was that sequence realistic in a way? I know it's still in the sci-fi, but was it a realistic scene of a shooting spree? Or was it stylized?
Yeah, I mean, so it's the Wachowski siblings. So, I mean, you know, they're the Matrix folks. But it's, it's set in, for the most part, modern day. I think this sequence was supposed to be taking place in Germany, not to give anything away. But yeah, it's a fairly realistic depiction of what a person with a handgun could do to other humans who bleed out real blood. You know, I mean, it's graphic.
Yeah, and let me say that because I know you don't like him. But that's why I think a difference between, say, that and, say, Tarantino is that Tarantino is violent. Yes, I will say that Tarantino's stuff is very violent. But I will say usually his violence, not in all cases, like early on it was more realistic. But in certain times, some of his most violent stuff is fairly stylized.
No, and I know that's a defense used for Tarantino. And I,
since you brought
it
up,
I wasn't going to bring it up. I think that is an absolutely ridiculous defense of his films.
You think it is?
I think it is because, you know, it is like trying to say that, like, well, it's just unrealistic and no one will mistake it for reality. But, you know, I think,
Ben,
personally, I just find most of his films distasteful.
Ben.
But the sequence, I know you're going to, none of you are happy that I don't like Tarantino. I think he's a great filmmaker.
No, it's fine. It's fine.
I just have a question for you. I just have two questions.
Hit me before
you.
I keep ranting.
Okay. All right. No, I mean, I will get over the fact that you don't like Tarantino, but I want to ask you this. Why do most people like Tarantino?
I mean, I think basically for the reason that I think he's fantastic with dialogue. He's a fantastic writer. I think I respect him as a filmmaker. He's a fantastic filmmaker. I think this particular defense of the violence that he portrays as being almost like a caricature or a cartoon, I don't think it excuses the fact that it is, for the most part, like violently pornographic. Like I just don't find, I don't have any interest in it personally. That's my main.
You like Sam Peckinpah?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen enough Peckinpah films to really make the comparison, but yeah, it is a certain sense of this gratuitous American violence that I think mm-hmm. most other countries would ban, honestly, as either like NC-17 uh-huh. or whatever. I mean, famously, the sequence was turned black and white because of the amount of blood.
Yeah.
But I think that's, again, that's a very like American solution to the problem. It's like, well, turn it black and
that.
White so that people
I agree
don't
with that.
Connect blood to blood. You know what I mean? Like people, cutting people up with swords and having them bleed out in exaggerated ways doesn't necessarily rectify the fact that you're cutting them up with swords and maybe the blood coming out is...
Did you ever see 13 Assassins?
You're trying to pin me down and corner me on films that I think should be banned because of violence.
Here's the thing. You won't corner Ben on this topic. I can just say that right now. And I'm not disagreeing with... Because, for example, when you look at, say, Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, that's fairly realistic violence. Like, that's not overly stylized like in Kill Bill or even in Glorious Bastards or even Django.
Well, and let's make it very specific. Reservoir Dogs, the unrated cut, the DVD that really kind of made his name when it was shown at Sundance with the ear scene where he cuts the ear off. You cannot tell me. Okay, I've watched it. You cannot tell me that is significant to the story. That is, to me, as soon as I saw that,
character.
that is indicative of Tarantino's lust for blood. That is... No, argue against me. I leave it right there. You tell me why I'm wrong.
I mean, sure. Just using that scene right there, it's character development. We don't know anything more about Mr. Blonde in terms of him going insane in the store from other people. You need to see it for yourself. It's an iconic scene because he does the contrast. He makes this horrible sort of scene where a guy literally getting his ear cut off while a man is dancing to Steeler's Wheel, you know? I mean, so that's what makes it sort of iconic. It's the clash. It's wanting people... Here's what I think the difference might be for Ben for why I like Tarantino versus why some people like Tarantino. I like Tarantino for the interrogation sequence in the first scene of Inglourious Basterds. I like Tarantino for his conversations between mm-hmm. Jackie Brown and mm-hmm. Max Cherry. I like Tarantino mm-hmm. for the way he actually builds his characters. That's what makes me a Tarantino fanboy. The Tarantino fanboys that I don't particularly care for, oh my god, did you see how he got that guy's head just blown off right there? That was amazing. But they're forgetting that he does so intentionally. I know you're seeing it as sort of as a blood fetishist. Might have that. I can't speak mm-hmm. for the man on that. But in terms of mm-hmm. story development and what he's actually doing... and you have to go film by film and really scene by scene, honestly, to be perfectly fair. So let's go back. We'll stay with the ear scene. We are building that character with Mr. Blonde. That Michael Madsen mm-hmm. is just sort of there. He sort of seems to be kind of a wild guy, but we haven't really gotten a true sense of that yet. And having the ear sequence happen and having Tim Roth's character, Mr. Orange, is that right, if I remember correctly? Having Mr. Orange see it and then kill him, I mean, it's a massive part of the story because he knows that Mr. Blonde was going to go further. That's why he shoots and kills him. And this is what sets up the final mm-hmm. fantastic Mexican standoff that you get in the film. So I would argue in that sense, and at least in that particular instance, that it is intentional and it is for story purpose.
Yeah, and I've poked the wrong bee's nest because clearly Tarantino is a sacred cow amongst most people,
I'm just saying I want to be fair.
Yeah, and I will say this: every time I criticize him, without exception, I will say he is an exceptional filmmaker.
Ben does, and I
for the most part have seen a significant number of his films because of the absolute rave reviews that friends and family give to a lot of these films, and there's nothing about them that to me requires the sorts of things that take place, and that's just a.
And I think this gets back to a
central theme of what I feel like the way some of this shakes out over time is that to go big picture back to our topic, which is, I think that what we're seeing take place with these comedy or cable channels, these movies, we'll start to see it more and more as they are produced by people that don't necessarily have to adhere by the MPAA or they're released in unrated form, is that we're going to see more and more media that is very targeted at their group of people, at their genre, and at the, you know, without a better phrase, really, like the risque factors of those pieces of media will be contingent on who's going to see them, you know? And I think that that's ultimately probably just better. I think that that just better reflects, like, people's interests and people's preferences. And, you know, we're starting to see shows like Sense8, which I just don't think would have existed on even HBO. I mean, there's transgendered sex scenes in Sense8, which is really not that controversial in the sense that it reflects human culture and society, but would be very controversial if it was on broadcast television or even if it was on cable. It would be a thing that people would write articles about. And I think the fact that we don't see a ton of articles about it represents the fact that a lot of people just don't care. And, you know, I think over time, Tarantino will be able to make whatever films he wants to make. He won't have to make them black and white. He can have, you know, just gallons and gallons of red substance shoot out of characters in fanciful ways. And that will appeal to his audience. And really, people like me who don't like it don't have to stop that from existing in the world. I just don't have to watch it. You know, I mean, I think that's how this shakes out, really, for everybody.
Yeah, I have one question for you, Ben. This is kind of what is.
Don't rip my ear off just because you're interrogating me.
No. What is worse to you, seeing the violence or implying the violence? Because with the ear cutting scene, you don't actually see him cut it off. The camera doesn't pan to it. I'm just going this as an example, because you can go with a Dark Knight is that you don't see Joker do some of the stuff that he does. It's fairly violent. So I'm just wondering, what is worse, seeing the violence or not seeing the violence? Because when not seeing it, you put... No, I'm answering. Never mind. Continue. Sorry, your turn.
I mean, I'm sure the audience is bored with my own, like, you know, prudish belief.
I really want to know.
But for me personally, like, you know, for example, thrillers, films that include tense sequences about violence to the characters. When I'm watching a film, I inhabit almost every character on screen that's given some sort of role. When they're making a decision, I feel like I'm making that decision. So I don't like to watch thrillers or films that involve significant violence because I feel like I'm the person in that moment trying to figure out, you know, do I get my ear cut off or is there a way to escape this room that these people are coming at? I don't like, you know.
So you're not watching horror films at all.
I don't watch horror films at all.
So you're not doing The Witch, even though it's probably one of the best horror films made in the last decade. So
no, I mean, I watched the last film that I can give you the clearest example on is I watched Identity probably what 10 years ago or something like that.
Probably 15.
Yeah, 15 years ago with friends, and they were like, you know, you got to see this. You're gonna love this. And, of course, I hated it in every way, and it disturbed me significantly to the point where I'm still talking about it now. But, you know, as those characters are getting hunted down and someone's head ends up in, like, a laundry dryer or something like that, I don't even remember.
Yes.
But that...
Washing machine.
Yeah, a washing machine. I mean, I am, you know, because it ends in this ridiculous way where, what, one of the characters is the killer of all the other characters? I don't even know. But, you know, I am that... I am that person killing and being killed, and it's just not interesting to me. That's how I experience films. I don't know why.
Now, can I ask you this question, Ben? This is kind of off this, kind of going about what you were asking.
This is going to be the Ben Gertz show. Go ahead.
No, when because you, I mean you have a son,
yeah,
and so when you're from a parent perspective, when you're saying taking your son to a movie or something watching on TV, how do you go about that? What do you look at? Because you asked us if we had kids, what would we do? What do you do in that instance with your son?
Well, I'll give you an example that surprised me, honestly. You know, I have had to think about this quite a bit because I've seen, you know, hundreds and hundreds or, you know, over, you know, 1,500 films and easily thousands of things, right? I've just watched hours and hours of content, I think. So, you know, a lot of things just honestly don't bother me that much. But I remember over Thanksgiving, I believe, there was a John Wayne marathon going on Satellite or whatever. And they were playing old John Wayne films. And everybody just was sitting around watching these things. And there was a John Wayne film I had never seen, so I was kind of paying attention to it. And... And you know, basically they're, you know, John Wayne and his little group of guys, they're running off of some horses, and these bad guys come along, and they're up on a ridge, and they shoot one of the horses out from under the good guys. And this is a very detailed story, but all that to say, you know, my son was in the room watching it, and you know, I won't forget this because it really did disturb me. But he saw mm-hmm. this take place, and he immediately turned around to me, and he looked up at me with really just like huge tears in his eye forming, and he was like, "Dad, we have to go get those bad guys that shot that horse. We mm-hmm. have to go get those bad guys."
Good reaction.
And it was this very like, it was this guttural, just animalistic reaction from him that really shocked me, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it made me think that if he had a gun, he would go to war right there. you know, and for me, yeah. I had experienced this and thought it almost comical because it was mm-hmm. this ridiculous rifle and the horse just fell down and, you know, the guy wasn't even mm-hmm. hurt. It was this fairly ridiculous, you know, 1950s, 1960s moment in this film. Yeah. And it deeply bothered him. I mean, he started mm-hmm. crying. We had to leave the room because he was so bothered by what had happened. I had to explain to him that mm-hmm. it wasn't real, and this, you know, this was just a story that they were telling, and that everyone was going to be okay. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
Twitter, you know, send me a tweet if you think that was a horrible way to handle the situation. But you know, we had to have this conversation about it, and you know, it reminds me that honestly, you know, my reading of all this since we brought the topic up is, violence is mm-hmm. definitely, at least for a little, you know, for a little boy, I'm much more aware of him seeing violence just because of how mm-hmm. quickly he starts telling me about what his friends have told him,
right.
and the you know, violent yeah. things that he starts, you know, he picks yeah. up anything and it's a gun, and I'm not like a super Portland parent that takes it away and says we don't use guns ever or anything like that. I mm-hmm. just know that he's much more aware of it than, honestly, almost any other form, you know, like language is really just language for the most part. And nudity is, this is maybe too much into my parenting style, but I mean, it is just somewhat, you know, reflective of humanity. And the violence part yeah. of it is honestly more of what concerns me. And so I don't know. Mm-hmm. I have been thinking about it a lot, but.
Well, I think we can probably sum that up like this, Ben. It's that Americans love guns and they love sex. And so if you can put guns and sex together, you've made yourself a blockbuster, and or at least gotten enough people to go talk about it. And there's a lot of more ways you go and dive into this about, you know, our religious inputs and our cultural conceptions of violence and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
There's some great papers and research I've read on this stuff before as well. But I really do think, though, that you, mm-hmm. and especially with your story with your son, I love that story, is because that's the reaction that you want as a filmmaker, is that you want your audience, if you've yeah. done your job right, to feel something about what happens on screen. Mm-hmm. Now, the beauty is, I think, and I will tie this mm-hmm. into Tarantino just to annoy you a little bit, is when I see Tarantino, especially in Django, with that final shootout sequence, with its over-the-top, you know, body bags and explosions of gore and violence.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I see that, I start laughing. And I remember laughing in the film because this is ridiculous. This is silly. This is stupid. Mm-hmm. And because what mm-hmm. he's doing there with, he's doing the same thing with Sam Peckinpah with the Wild Bunch, that it being over-the-top violence for the point of to make people say, this is kind of pointless. And ultimately, that's the sort of reaction I think you want to get, that the violence, especially in The Hateful Eight, is supposed to disturb you. It's not glorified at all, I would argue. I actually didn't end up writing a review for it as much as I wanted to, but that film, even though the last 30 minutes are very violent and very dark, it's not a celebration at all. It is, quite frankly, a rejection mm-hmm. of the sort of the stereotypes that we'd expect that everything's supposed to end in this sort of glorious spectacle. The same thing goes with mm-hmm. Clint Eastwood with Unforgiven. That's a Western that rejects gun violence and is a critique of gun violence and gun culture. It's incredible. But that's what filmmakers want. They want you to have that
reaction.
Yeah,
and, you know, I agree with that. You know, I just watched Sicario, you know, which has extremely graphic sequences.
The dinner
at the
table
beginning.
At the end.
I mean,
not in that.
I mean, there's bodies stacked in the walls, you know, of the drug houses.
Yeah.
There's just really horrifying sequences in that film. And, you know, I agree with your basic premise that I think the filmmaker's goal in those moments is to horrify us by mm-hmm. humanity and the possibilities of violence and to, you know, potentially, you know, be against it in some form. Or, you know, I mean, the mm-hmm. question of Sicario is there anything to really be against or for, I suppose?
Oh, there's tons of that.
Yeah. But here's, as a viewer, you know, I found more and more that, you know, maybe I'm just getting old and cantankerous, but I just don't find that general, you know, that the basic thrust that you're saying of, well, the filmmaker is doing this to make you feel outraged or to mm-hmm. traumatize you by violence or by, you know, graphic things that happen to women or to, you know, different groups of people or whatever. I don't know if I'm just getting, you know, older or something like that, but I just don't find that as interesting anymore. I'm really, mm-hmm. I'm bothered by it in a way that makes me want to not watch it, which is very close. Mm-hmm. I'm parsing something that's very similar. It is very similar to, you know, I'm bothered by it, right? But I'm bothered mm-hmm. by it in a way that makes me think, like, I already know that drug cartels and violence is terrible. You know, I've known that. Mm-hmm. You're not really expanding my worldview in any real way, and especially in the context of this is a constructed narrative. This is a written narrative that is fictional. This is not reality. It's supposed to reflect reality. I got that. But this is not a documentary. And so as entertainment, I don't find it entertaining. And it makes me, honestly, just kind of more and more, you know, gravitate away from those types of things. I don't, when I was younger, yeah, show me how terrible the world is. I need to be hyper aware of the world that we live in. But now, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm getting ready to be on Fox News and just sit in my recliner, but I don't find it nearly as compelling to recommend films like Sicario, even though I think it's a fantastic film for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah, I'm going to go off that just to kind of tie it a little bit back in, but I can say when I went to go see Deadpool, that I had parents and two kid walk at a certain point in the movie. It was not when the violence happened. It was after the sex montage happened is when they walked out. And I think you're in the majority of that. I know a lot of parents who don't think too much about violence. The same with the MPAA is. They don't think as much about violence. They think more about sex. Is that that family hightailed it out of there when the sex montage happened? But it was okay when Deadpool was chopping the guy's head off. It's like that's the way it was. So I think I'm not saying you're going to be on Fox News or anything because I think it'd be the opposite. They'd be okay with the violence. But I'm just I agree with what you're saying, and I not to the extent that you're saying, but I agree that I mean. I don't know.
I'm with you. And really, if anything, just like in most of our episodes, this does kind of make me think of other topics to bring up. But I think we probably got to wrap it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, we don't have enough time.
In a lot of ways.
Well, let's wrap it up. So, real quick, give us a recommendation of something for everyone to go see, listen to, read, watch.
I'll go first. This is going to be a book, which is very much in line with the Portland theme, right? I just sit around and read books all the time. The Three Body Problem. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. It's the first, let me get this right, I believe, but I'm pretty sure it's the first Chinese language book or author to win the Nebula Award, which is a prize given to the best science fiction book. But I'm in the second book of the series, The Dark Forest. It's really, really interesting, mm-hmm. and I don't know how it'll be brought to the big screen, but I imagine there is someone mm-hmm. definitely working on it, for sure, because it's very visual. There's some just fantastic sequences and story and character. It's a huge cast of characters. It's on a truly universal scale. It's the entire universe. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. When did it come out again?
The first one came out. It was translated into English. This says very recently, but I think that that's wrong on Amazon. Anyway, it's recent. I bought it the day after Christmas, 2015. Okay. Finished the first book, and now I'm on the second one.
Okay.
They haven't translated the third one yet, so I'm really upset because I'm getting ready to run out of runway here before the next one's ready.
Okay. So, Will, what do you have?
Okay, well, since Ben started out with a book there, I'll also give you a book. Lost in the Cosmos by Walker Percy. I cannot recommend this book enough. It was published in 1983. Walker Percy is one of my favorite writers, Southern writer and thinker. Specifically, the book uses basically the question, back during the 80s when we had the whole self-help movement, the self-help movement's come back, there was a million books that were about how to find yourself and improve yourself. And so Walker Percy wrote a book called Lost in the Cosmos, the last self-help book, both as a satire of self-help books and also to ask the bigger questions that self-help books kept ignoring, which were ultimately his point being, do you really understand and know who you are? That humanity's ultimate problem is an endemic identity crisis since the dawn of civilization, and how we understand ourselves and the world around us using symbols and semiotics helps us understand ourselves and relate to other people. It's an incredible book. It's very fun. It's witty. It's thought-provoking. Some great little tidbits here and there, but I cannot recommend that one enough.
Well, I'm going to recommend two movies since we just did books. Yeah, I can, Ben. Don't shake your head at me. First one I'm gonna recommend Goosebumps movie, based off books. I was highly surprised by Goosebumps. I know we talked about on the show at one point that it didn't look that great, and I was really worried, but it's actually fairly funny. And
I saw it. It's not bad.
It's not bad at all. And it's, it might be too dark for your son, Ben, but I thought it was a good little film. And it, I compare it to Casper, but not as dark as Casper, because Casper gets fairly dark in spots, and I thought it was a fun, like, entertaining film. And I also think I saw Tomorrowland this year, and I think Goosebumps did a better job of telling a story that Tomorrowland was trying to tell, or the structure of it, because it had a good story structure to it. I thought that was a good job that the writers did with it, and we'll get a sequel as well. The other movie I'm going to recommend, it is, and this is kind of in honor of Harper Lee, it's a little documentary called Hey Boo, Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird. If you're a fan of To Kill a Mockingbird, and Neil Harper Lee just recently passed away, it's a good documentary they did about the impact of the book and a little bit more in depth of Nell's life and her relationship with Truman Capote and all these people, and interviews a lot of great writers and celebrities talking about the importance of Harper Lee. And yeah, it's, if you guys haven't seen it, check it out if you like To Kill a Mockingbird, or if you're like Hunter, who also likes Ghost at a Watchman. Ben, did you ever read that book?
I didn't. We'll have to cover it in another episode.
Okay. Well, yeah, so that's our recommendations. Ben, do you have anything to say? Last thoughts?
Time to go.
Okay, so make sure you follow us on Twitter at Cinenation Show, and like us on Facebook, and follow us on Medium. Hunter has been doing a lot of work this past week on Medium, so he's gotten a lot of good articles and reviews. Make sure you check that out. Also, make sure you subscribe on iTunes. Write any reviews you have for us. Tell us what you think. We want to make sure that we make the show as best we can. We also have a few announcements coming up soon, some stuff we're trying to do through Cinenation, and hope you guys will stay tuned for that.
That'd be dope.
It's
going to be
great. Thanks for having me, guys.
It's going to be great. So, yeah. Thank you, Will, for coming on. Thank you guys for listening. Bye.